and so on and so forth. We'll see. I just don't know what's going to happen. The point is, while it's a disaster at the national level, it's had virtually no impact at the state and local level. So because of the charters and so forth, the unity charters, whatever we're calling them, the disaffiliation of Change the Wind at the national level, I think, has had virtually no impact in New York. We have New York, for its size, for its I don't want to call them prima donnas, but all very bright, powerful political leaders you have in the state, and all the diversity we have in the state. I keep remarking to Dennis Hughes, it's just, I think, remarkable that the unity and the stability is as great as it is in New York State. And so all the groups that left are still actively participating in the state Fed, on our board, on our programs, on our ELFs, and so on. I think part of that has to do with a philosophy of leadership that Dennis really reflects a little more than I think Ed Cleary. And that is, how do you define the role of the state federation and its officers? Some states, the state federation presidents think they're the king of the labor movement. They're the god, and they're the boss, and they're the dictator of the labor movement, and whatever they say. We have a very different philosophy in New York. We know that we borrow our power from our affiliates. Our goal is to to coalesce the affiliates, to bring affiliates together, to provide leadership in a way that we're able to tap the resources of our affiliates and mobilize them to get things done. Classic example of that, on the public sector side, was the cost of living increase for public employee pensions. For a long time, each public employee union went in and said, well, this is what I want in terms of a COLA, or I want this, or I want that, or I want this pension reform, and so on. They finally said, with Dennis' leadership and Art Wilcox, bring all the people together in the public sector and say, look, if we have one bill, if we have one program, and we all get behind it, and the state Fed provides the leadership, and you provide us the resources to mount the PR campaign, and you provide us the political organization so that we're all speaking with the same voice, and we all bring our members together in Albany on the same day for the same rally, and it's the state AFL-CIO rally, we might be able to get something done. Well, we did that. That took leadership, took coordination on the part of the state AFL-CIO, but that wouldn't happen unless there was a willingness on the part of major unions, NYSET, CSEA, and others, to kind of subserve themselves within the state federation umbrella and not say, we're going to be the lead here. We're going to work within the state federation. We're going to compromise, and we're going to get this done. And that happened. We had a major rally. We got a permanent cost of living increase. Now, what happens? We don't send out our newsletter claiming we get all the credit. The NYSET newspaper, the CSEA newspaper, banner headlines, NYSET wins COLA, CSEA wins COLA. And that's fine. They get the credit, they're the ones that deal with the members and so on. And everybody knows what the process was, but every union newspaper, of course, claims victory for every major thing that there was out there. And that's fine. And so we understand that that's where the power is, and we've got to meet the needs of those political people who vote for us, keep us in power. We're not dictating them, telling them what to do. Our job is very different, of trying to, facilitate, I guess is the word I'm looking for, to facilitate a common agenda and then promote that. We've done it in terms of defeating governor's budget proposals, defeating a constitutional convention in New York. We have a $5 million budget in New York State AFL-CIO. NYSET has a $100-some-odd million budget. We're not able to generate those resources, but if we say there is a constitutional convention proposed, and that has the danger of taking away the constitutional guarantee that you can't mess with public employee pensions, we need to do something. So what we do is, with our Susie Ballantyne, our political director, we're working with experts, pull all the political directors together, put a plan together, bring in Mike Sheehan from Washington. I don't know if you know him. He's really an expert on putting these things together. Put together a plan. It's got a organizing plan. It's got a PR campaign. It's got an advertising campaign. NYSHA throws in a couple hundred thousand. CSEA throws in whatever they have to throw in. They throw into one pot under Susie's direction, under Dennis's overall direction, working with the political directors. And we do television spots, radio spots, newspapers. We could not do by ourselves. Or they couldn't do. Now, they still have their own campaigns on their own issues. PEFA's had a great campaign on privatization and so on and so forth. But the issues that affect everybody, we're able to do that. And endorsements, you know, a Spitzer race or Hillary's race and so on, we do the same thing. People, we are very big and powerful unions. We have very powerful political directors. Alan Lubin is one of the most powerful political people in the state, NYSHA's political guy. Well, he works with Susie, he works with the others in a way that, you know, strengthens the entire labor movement. So NYSHA, being the biggest and the most powerful and the wealthiest, can see now its decision to work with and through the AFL-CIO has immeasurably strengthened the state federation in the state, but also it strengthened their own union by making sure that we can deliver things they need for their members. That's pretty unique. And in a place like New York with, you know, the nature of the labor movement here, one would think that there would be internecine warfare all the time, and we just have not had it. And I think a lot of that credit goes to the quality of people like Dennis Hughes and Tom Hobart and Alan Lubin and Danny Donahue and, you know, other leaders who understand how the system should work. Not true in every state. Certainly not true nationally. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
I think that's a good way to stop it.
Yeah.
That's okay. Good. Cool.
My pleasure.
Okay, why don't we continue to talk about the Democracy Committee of the AFT?
Yeah, so I was telling folks, I think it's one of the great untold stories of the labor movement, both the AFT and the AFL-CIO. And that starts with the fundamental principle that if you start with the concept of the dignity and rights of every human being and their dignity and worth, for example, and a universal declaration of human rights and how to guarantee those, the labor movement in this country, the AFL-CIO historically and the AFT have said that those rights are best protected in democratic, free and democratic societies. And in order to have free and democratic societies, it's more than just elections, as we're just seeing now. You have to have free and democratic institutions that have to be part of those societies. And key among those institutions is a free and democratic trade union movement, one that's free of government interference, that's unlike the old communist unions, that's not part of the government structure and takes its orders from the commissars, but truly represent the workers. So the AFT and the AFL-CIO historically have had a long commitment to promoting free and democratic trade unions around the world. Going back even back to World War II, when Irving Brown, as the AFL-CIO representative in Europe, went in to make sure that this battle after the end of World War II between the free trade unions and the communist unions over who would control the labor movements in those countries, and therefore maybe even the destiny of those countries, worked very hard to make sure that the unions in France and Germany and elsewhere were free and democratic union, where the communist efforts were to try to start unions and, for example, to undermine the Marshall Plan so that the economies would not grow and be successful. It's a wonderful story, and one that people don't know about is that the reason that Europe was successful in recovering from World War II was because they were flourishing democracies and economies, but they would not have been so without strong and free and democratic trade union movements with the American labor movement helped to work on. The whole story of Solidarność. Solidarność would not have been successful without the support of the AFL-CIO and the AFT. They provided simple things like copy machines and paper and other kinds of things so that the Solidarność movement would have the institutional wherewithal to be successful and to be stable and to work with them. Plus, in the World Forum, promoting the rights of those workers and rejecting recognition of any union that was from the Soviet Union or China or elsewhere who really weren't unions at all, and working with the dissidents who really wanted to be leaders of free trade union movement. So the success of Solidarnosc was a lot, as they will say, to the support of the American labor movement. The freedom of in South Africa, the ending of apartheid, and ended in very large part, I would argue, because of the role of free trade union movements there, which were supported by the American labor movement. I myself was an observer, along with some other AFT people, in Chile when they had the plebiscite to what they called the no vote, when the dictator wanted to continue in office, and the vote was to say no, that he couldn't continue in office, and we were invited down by the Chilean Teachers Union to observe that election, so that a number of us went down there in that to promote freedom and democracy in Chile by having make sure that the teachers union, among other labor movements, were free and democratic so they could help stabilize the democracy in that country. After the Education International Conference in Thailand, I was asked by the International Affairs Department to go up to meet with Burmese refugees on the Burmese border in upper Thailand, members of the Karen who were being slaughtered and murdered and so forth in Burma by the dictator there. Dictatorship there, and they had set up a camp, refugee camp, and we went in and with Helen Toth of the AFT International Department and visited their campsite, which is really mud huts on the side of a hill, and spoke probably to 200 or 300 teachers who had set up a school system there, and to talk about how important their work was and how we could support the teachers union actually in this refugee camp, and how important it was to educate their children about democracy, and that we're working someday to make sure that the military dictatorship in Burma falls, and these people will be able to go back to Burma, and they will be educated and prepared to assume leadership roles in their, in their political system and their economy and so forth. Very rewarding. It's very frustrating in one sense because they're still there and it's not successful, but to have that opportunity. The opportunity to travel to Tanzania and work with the Tanzanian Teachers Union to train teachers in 3 or 4 locations. There were 2 of us. I did the southern part of Tanzania over a period of two weeks to do training sessions for teachers in Tanzania on how to teach their students about democracy, because Tanzania moving toward a pluralistic democratic society, but the teachers had not had a lot of experience about how to do that, and so giving them strategies of how to engage students in democratic decision-making activities in the classroom, and to train really a cadre of teachers or train trainers to go back to their other communities to train other teachers. More recently, coming back from Beirut, Lebanon, of all places, where we met with the private teachers union and the public teachers union on kind of training that they need to be more effective and more democratic unions. And also, again, if they are one institutions in a place like Lebanon that are democratic and themselves and want and promote democracy within Lebanon, to strengthen them institutionally and help them become more effective in being a good union, but also in being more of a voice in providing education reform, is going to help the democratization process in in a place like Lebanon. So there are all these activities, and serving on the AFT Democracy Committee, where we're working with teachers in the Republic of Georgia, or in Bosnia, or in other places, to do what we can, and now even in Iraq, to work with teachers, mostly meeting with them outside of Iraq because of the dangers there. But if Iraq is going, despite all our problems with the war and how the war started and all the follies of this administration, the fact is that if there's going to be any chance for democracy in Iraq, they're going to have free and democratic institutions, and that means a free and democratic labor movement, and key among them, because of who they are teacher unions. And so work with Iraqi teachers on you know, building an effective and free and democratic teachers union. So there's some hope there. The program we did in Beirut, we hopefully would invite other Arab, Palestinian people to come in to see, you know, we can build some bridges there as part of an overall effort to reach out. And the reception we had over there was pretty amazing, because when you meet with people like that, you understand they really do have a desire for democracy, especially teachers, and they have a desire to have an effective and democratic government, but also effective and democratic unions. So hopefully from that effort, others will come in and look at the program and maybe it will move in some others. Long-range plans, I don't think it's pie in the sky. It's very hard work and tough work, but it's something that has to be done. So Herb Magnuson, for years, the AFT Vice President, has led the Democracy Committee, and I can never heap enough praise on him and for the work he's done. But this all really, as part, was led by initially the vision of Al Shanker and his commitment to human rights and democracy. People view him as a tough and militant trade union leader, which he was, and an education reformer, which he also was, transformed from what people saw as a militant trade union leader to really the leading educational statesman in the country. So people recognize that because of his New York Times column, and the other work he did. But less known about Al is this very strong commitment toward freedom and democracy around the world and support for free and democratic trade unions, and was at the forefront of the AFT effort and also the AFL-CIO effort. That resulted in Al Shanker believing that leaders of the AFT ought to have every opportunity they can to travel internationally to begin to absorb some of these ideas and lessons. And so I, along with a number of other AFT vice presidents, have done extensive international travel. Early on, there was a program with the Labor Desk, United States Labor Desk, where they sent groups of young trade union leaders. I went on three of these, first as a participant, second to as a leadership role, where they would take a dozen trade union leaders and send us to Europe, where we would go probably to France and Belgium and maybe Germany or the UK and meet with the labor movements there. Meet with each political party there, and try to understand, you know, how they were organized, what they were doing, and if you take all of those experiences, you can better understand what their views are, what the traditions and ideology of European labor movement is versus the American labor movement. It can only help you better understand what your labor movement could and should be and shouldn't and could not be. For example, I had an interview with a reporter, I don't know how she got my name, from a French newspaper about a week ago. I wanted to talk about the American labor movement. So she says she wants to call back because there is this fundamental difference in European trade union and here. You just went through a huge general strike, essentially, in France, unions and others, and that's just not the tradition in the United States. So it's important to kind of explore that, our tradition of rugged individualism and our capitalistic system and the nature of the movement here. And there's never been a class culture developed in this country, whether you have class cultures there. Class culture means, probably to oversimplify, you're in a role, you're probably going to be there in your role, and you need your class to do what it can to improve the class. Here, again, oversimplified, people think, well, this is transitionary, I'm going to move out or up and so on, so they don't view themselves, got this rugged individual. So there are very fundamental differences, but to understand those and view the roles of those, I think is it can only help, obviously, not only in understanding our own labor movement, labor movements around the world, but it comes back to this whole idea of education, and how education can be improved, and what role labor, teaching about labor movement, because when we talk about the American Labor Studies Center, one of our goals eventually is to help students in the 10th grade, 9th and 10th grade global studies understand labor movements elsewhere. I've already got a box of materials from the Canadian Labor Congress that they want. We'll be able to do the same thing with Ireland. But it's important for kids to understand these issues. They look at a contemporary world and they say, well, you had an election here and there and that means a democracy, without really understanding that, you know, democratic institution building is important and that unions are important in promoting democracy and protecting human rights around the world.
You got me there?
That's it. It's an important story, I think.
It is. It's very important.